Well, let's welcome back manager Chris Coast. Chris, do you have any team updates for us?
Not really. We're in a situation where we're just trying to solidify our pitching staff and minimize some injuries. The only real situation is keeping an eye on Dylan Kelly, a little tweak of the hamstring, and then actually also Jordan Patterson, a little tweak of the groin area. Neither one are on the injured list just yet, but a couple of those situations where we're monitoring. So offensively, just trying to find our stride and stay healthy, like I'm sure all the teams are.
Before jumping into fan questions, I want to ask you something off of yesterday's game. You have that dramatic ninth inning comeback to win. Then you have a day off. Does that still carry over into the next, you know, Tuesday's game, or do you kind of lose that momentum a little bit from that excitement?
Yeah, I'm not sure how much the momentum was a concern. You know, it's certainly something you think about, like you have a good game and then you have an off day. Would you rather just continue to play right away? But I think it's one of those situations where as you travel, most of us love being in Chicago is where we're. It's a beautiful ballpark. It was a fun series. I think we welcome the off day more so because of the guys we have just slightly banged up. Like I had mentioned with Jordan Patterson, Dylan Kelly, it gives us an extra day. Certainly gives our bullpen an extra day, because if we've had one area of concern as far as health goes, it's probably our bullpen arms, and not with injuries, but being overused to a certain extent. So we will welcome an off day when we can get it at this stage.
Well, we'll jump into fan questions, and we start with Ken, who would like to know, how much of an advantage do you believe it is in playing so many of your games this season in Newman Outdoor Field?
It's tough to say. Typically, a championship-level team plays really, really well at home, so there's something to be said for that. The comfort of after the game, going back to your own home. And even though the players are not from Fargo, if they have an apartment, a host family, it feels like home, less travel. So whether it's an advantage or not, I guess that will determine it at the end of the year. But when we were at home for so long, it was great being at home. But every now and then, you do enjoy a road trip. I'll say that. Like, when you look back on your playing career, some of the best times were bus trips, hotels on the road, going out to eat with the guys, maybe after games, things like that. So as much as we do love being at home because Fargo is a great place to play, sometimes a nice little road trip can get a team going. So that's kind of hopefully what we're looking for. We won 2 out of 3 in Chicago, and we are excited to get back home, and hopefully the fans are excited to have us back as well.
We have a couple from Gary. The first is, would you mind sharing your philosophy on a couple of things? When do you feel it is necessary to play your infield in?
Depends how important that run at third is. That's a big part of it. Some of it also has to do with where you're at in the game, first inning, ninth inning, somewhere in between. The other factor is going to be, do you have confidence that your offense can score runs against the opposing pitching? If you feel like every run is going to be the difference in a game where it's going to be a low-scoring game, you're more likely to play your infield in early. If you have confidence that you're going to score 7-8 runs over the course of the game, then infield in isn't as necessary. The other consideration a lot of managers would think of is you may not play the infield in until the batter has 2 strikes, because then when a hitter is in 2-strike mode, they're more likely to hit a softer ground ball. They're going to expand the zone, and infield in at that point might make more sense. So there's a lot of different factors that go into playing infield in. And I'll be honest with you, in my many, many years in baseball, it's the first time I've been asked like that broad of a question. I was happy to answer it. That was a good question.
Well, that's good, because Gary would also like to ask, when a manager plays his defense in early on in a game, everyone seems to criticize him for giving in too early. Why is that a bad idea to stop runs from scoring early in the game?
Well, it has so much to do if you have faith that your offense can score runs. You know, for example, if you're facing John Smoltz in his prime and you know that you're going to be fighting to get the 3 runs, you might be more likely to play your infield in. You know, because it's not a freebie. It's like there are potential consequences to playing your infield in. You are also susceptible to a weaker hit, a blooper over the infield, a ground ball that gets through. There's also the consideration of if there's runners on second and third, because it's not just about that run scoring from third. If a weak hit gets through a drawn in infield, now you're going to be able to, or you're going to be giving up two runs. So there's something to be said for that too. And it's those decisions that you make, and you try to follow the book to a certain extent. And some of it has to do with the pitching matchup on the hitter. If you have a softer hitting, you know, maybe a shortstop who doesn't drive the ball a lot, you're more likely to get a softer ground ball you might play the infield in. So there's all different parameters involved. There's no one perfect way to do it. But if you follow the book, odds are you're going to come out on the right side of it more often than not.
Jerry asked, you two talked about last week about not, oh, I'm sorry, let me rephrase. Okay, here we go. Sorry, I was reading this wrong. Jerry says, you two talked about guys not being given a chance because they don't have the big velocity. Isn't this really about winning, and that's really what should decide whether a guy can compete at the highest level?
In our league, absolutely. But in professional baseball, when the minor leagues are specifically for development, they try to win the game, but it's secondary to the development of players. If you were to see what goes on behind the scenes in organized baseball, you go to like a high A ball game in the Florida State League, for example, the manager only has so much flexibility. The pitching plan is already designed for that day. A pitcher might come in and they're going to be less worried about stats, and he's going to throw two innings and he's going to throw a lot of breaking balls because he needs to work on his breaking ball. So that's where that comes in. It's at the major league level, yes, absolutely, it's all about the winning. But to get to the major leagues, you have to be given a chance in the minor leagues, and that's where the lack of velocity can hurt a lot of guys, even though statistically, if given a chance over the course of, let's say, 20 starts or maybe 30 bullpen innings, they would have success, improve it. If their radar gun doesn't dictate that to scouts, they may not get a chance. And we talked about like a Jamie Moyer, I think is the name that came up. It would be really hard for him in today's game to get a legitimate shot like after college. So it's become tougher in that regard. However, I'll say this, is like guys need to know how to pitch. And I think in 10 years, if we were to have this conversation, the level of pitching in 10 years from now is going to be, well, you can't even comprehend how good it's going to be, because instead of just being power, power is going to be there. Now guys in 10 years are going to be able to pitch. They're going to be able to locate a lot more, to throw breaking balls wherever they want it. It's just the evolution of pitching. It's become a power game, but in 10 years, the league will adjust, and you'll have power with guys who can also pitch. It's going to be pretty scary.
Sam says, with no summer baseball, what do you suggest that players do who are entering their junior or senior year in high school to keep their timing and good eye at the plate?
That is a really tough one, because you can practice and practice and practice, and that is incredibly important. The value of a practice and training, you can't put a value on it. However, you also do need to compete, because that's also one of those things that just cannot be measured by scouts or evaluators, as a guy's ability to compete with the game on the line or do what a team needs at a particular stage. So training is important, but young players need to also play. I'm not saying play 190 games a year and travel ball, things like that, but you do need to compete. You do need to have pressure put on you to succeed and learn to deal with failure. I think a lot of places around the country are probably more fortunate than others. Like where I live in North Dakota, Minnesota, there's actually a really good amount of summer baseball going on right now. So kids are playing like crazy, actually. I know the Legion team in Fargo has probably played 40 games by this point. So if you're lucky enough to be in an area where baseball is still working out, you're in pretty good shape.
Kind of a reverse year when it's North Dakota that people are playing baseball in and not California or something.
Yep.
Very weird year. Jim says, it was interesting your thoughts on playing one sport or not doing so. There is concern about kids getting burned out on only playing one sport. Is your reasoning for saying it is okay because of their love of the sport?
Yes, that's the primary reason. Because once again, like I have daughters, right? And they both love volleyball. If they wanted to play four sports or three sports, I would heavily encourage it. If they wanted to focus on volleyball because the opportunity is there and they love the sport so much, I'm all for it. It's different than 20 years ago where there was limited opportunities for people who played one or minimal sports. And I'm not saying that a person should, I want to make that clear. I'm not saying a kid should be forced to choose. If a kid wants to play three sports, they're good at it, they have a passion for it, they should be able to play multiple sports. But to say a kid has to play multiple sports just doesn't cover all the scenarios. Because I'll say this, if I had a son, I would not want him pitching 10, 11 months out of the year. I think that just makes sense. Why would you want your kid to have that kind of wear and tear on your arm? But to swing a bat, to take ground balls, as long as you're not at risk of being burnt out, because there's that concern too. If you only play one sport, you're at risk of being burnt out if you're doing it 365 days a year. So it has so much to do with the individual athlete combined with the opportunities available to that individual athlete. So it's almost has to be a case by case basis.
You know, I want to ask you off that because I see a lot of pitchers head to the winter leagues to play in Australia or Venezuela or something. And I'm wondering, I mean, that's like 10 or 11 months you're pitching on your arm. Do you think that that's a necessarily a good thing, or you should give your arm a rest for a bit?
Well, in a perfect world, you're a major leaguer making $10 million and you can afford to do that. But that's the unfortunate reality of a minor league player is – when you're in the minor leagues, even if you're a AAA free agent where you can make a little bit of money, you're not going to get rich, but you might make $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 a month over the course of 5 months, right? It's not a ton of money, but it legitimizes doing it. And then you have an opportunity to go to, say, the Mexican Winter League or Australia and make another potentially $40,000 to $45,000. You're probably going to do it because that's the best way to keep the dream alive financially. So many times a guy is pushed into retirement for financial concerns. Maybe he has a degree from Columbia and it needs to get used at some point, so he's more likely to, if he has a job waiting for him and a different career path. So that's the issue. Now, I did that for many, many years where I played, there was a couple, 2 years in a row where I played basically 11 months out of the year. Now, I wasn't a pitcher. I loved doing it, and it also made me better. But I was also 30 years old at the time, so it wasn't a situation where I was going to get burnt out. It was make a little bit extra money. I loved baseball. I was in pretty good places. So another kind of a case-by-case basis situation.
David, like to know, did you feel it was a coincidence that the Nationals won the World Series the year after Bryce Harper left?
I believe it was a coincidence. I, to be honest with you, I loved it too. It's a great storyline. Bryce Harper is a superstar player, but it's more proof of the team sport concept. You could have the world's best pitcher, but he can only go out there once every 5 days, for example. You could have the world's best hitter in Barry Bonds, let's say. He only comes to bat four or five times a game. So you cannot win with just a superstar alone. You have to have a well-rounded group of guys. And if you look at a lot of championship-level teams, it's riddled with superstars, a lot of middle in-between players who contribute, and some young stars as well. I mean, Nationals had the pitching, but they also had Juan Soto, who's like 12 years old, it seems like, you know. So it's, and I believe Juan Soto, I think he might have just turned 21 and is one of the best hitters in the world. So it's probably a coincidence that they won the World Series the first year without Bryce Harper, but what an awesome storyline.
Damon would like to know who you see in the World Series this year.
That's a tough one. With so little information on who's ready and a shortened season, you know, in a normal 162 game season, you can do all the analysis and superstar players, but with very little information, it's going to be something similar to last year probably, where you'd have to pick Washington or LA versus, let's say, the Yankees. But at the same time, there's always that one team that could surprise you. I'm not going to sit here and take the Oakland A's, but if the Oakland A's make the playoffs and win a World Series, it would also not be surprising because of the format and guys getting hot and some young players emerging, superstar players maybe not as prepared or a different scenario than in a normal year, because baseball players are addicted to routine. That's one of the things that's common in our life is this routine that we've had is kind of out the window to a certain extent. And so now to get back to it, it'll be interesting to see how certain guys respond. However, players who are gifted can fall out of bed and get hits. You know, like I'm going to use Juan Soto with the Nationals again. Juan Soto could probably not take batting practice for a month, fall out of bed, and hit 100 mile an hour fastball over the fence whenever he wanted. So, once again, it's going to come down to the better players.
Greg says, I saw that Carlton canceled all their fall sports. Do you think that the MIAC could cancel all sports this season so there's no Cobbers baseball?
I would be incredibly disappointed if that's the case. Once again, nothing would be surprising. That would be a decision that would hopefully come way into the future based on current information that would be out there at those times. You know, it's you have to do what's best for the athletes and the public and everybody in between and staff members and student bodies and things like that. So a lot of smart people, you know, in position to hopefully make some really well-informed, educated decisions. If they move fall sports to the spring, if that was to do it, I think we all accept whatever scenario as long as we're able to have a season of some kind. I sit back and hold my breath. You know, we lost our season last year. It was a tough one, so the potential of things like this happening again would be, it'd be tough to handle. We would handle whatever comes our way, but hopefully that's not going to be the case as far as all sports. I think we will find a way, and by November, whether it's baseball decisions or even January, February baseball decisions, I think there's ways to make it happen, which is once again, in my opinion, why it's so important for the American Association to succeed and figure out ways to do it. Even if we have a little hiccup with something as far as health concerns, you know, we can maybe set a little blueprint of how to do things, and here's how we can do it successfully and, more importantly, safe for everybody involved, because the people that maybe aren't involved in sports might say, oh, it's just a sport, it's not a big deal. But those of us that have been involved in sports our entire lives have seen how just 4 years of a college baseball program or 4 years of a college football program can drastically change someone's life for the better. It puts them on a path that they would not have been able to be on mentally, physically, maturity, the ability to deal with adversity, handle success and failure, respect for teammates and just general people. So to not have seasons would be a detriment to a lot of people.
And I think, too, in talking with a lot of college kids, the friendships they make seem to be long-lasting and lifetime ones.
No question, my best friends to this day are most of my college friends, and not one of them had I met before I come to college. So certainly it's more than just the balls and strikes or touchdowns or goals and points and things like that. That's one of the many awesome things about college sports is you are developing relationships over 3 to 4 years that literally last a lifetime. It's pretty incredible.
Lydia would like to know what you do to pass the time on these long bus rides.
Just got off a bus ride from Chicago, and here's exactly how it went. We had a 7 o'clock game in Chicago, and it was a long game. It was, you know, we went to the bottom of the ninth, and we probably didn't get on the road until 12:30 at night. I had a sub from Firehouse Subs. I drank a bottle of water, put on my iPad a little, watched a few of the highlights, watched a program that I had recorded on my iPad, and then fell asleep, woke up 3 hours later, went back to sleep, woke up about an hour outside of Fargo, and before you know it, we were in Fargo. So that was one of the lucky trips where I was able to sleep. Now, if it's during the day, you know, you talk to guys, you talk to the coaches, the players go back and forth talking to each other to a certain extent in a normal year. In a situation where we're all wearing masks, even on a bus, it makes it a little bit tougher. But with the technology, with iPads and cell phones, it's amazing how much you can pass the time. But one thing that will never change is games of cards are still rampant on buses, on bus trips. Players still love to play cards. That will never change.
Zach would like to know, what's the best place to eat in the Fargo-Moorhead area?
Depends what you're looking for. If you're looking for your standard like Mexican restaurant, you got Paradiso or Mexican Village. Personally, I'm a huge fan of Spicy Pie Pizza. It's not your normal pizza place. The Buffalo Chicken Pizza, which is probably the only place I'd have Buffalo Chicken Pizza. It's also 50% off after a Red Hawks win. So We usually get a buffalo chicken pizza in the clubhouse for the coach and staff after a win. Other than that, honestly, I hate to admit this, but I'm a franchise kind of guy. I love Buffalo Wild Wings. I love Chick-fil-A. If you're looking for like a hole-in-the-wall breakfast place, there's a lot of those as well. Same thing for like bar and grill places, but you're not going to be able to get a lot of great recommendations for me in that regard. I'm somewhat of a picky eater. When I find a place I like, I stick to it, and you'll see me at Buffalo Wild Wings and Spicy Pie more often than not.
We have a couple of questions from Bob. The first is, I've been really impressed by how long you've been with your wife. So how did you know that she was the right one for you at such a young age?
Well, it seems like a long time ago, and how I actually knew, it was the fact that she understood my passion for baseball early on. And that's kind of the joke when I say that I had support from my wife. It was the first time that she ever really paid attention to who I was. I was playing first base for the Fargo Legion team back in 1989. So when we started dating, she knew exactly what she was getting herself into, and the level of support has been incredible, and it still is to this day. And I have two daughters who, because of my wife's support, are also incredibly supportive. So to answer that question, once again, it's the fact that her recognizing my passion for baseball and that I had a passion for something like that made it pretty easy to realize that, you know, this is important, because to have the support of family and wives and kids, it's not always there. And I've seen plenty of players put into retirement because they had to almost make a choice between family and their career. And if you have a family, you're probably going to choose your family. So I was incredibly lucky. I never was confronted with that.
Bob also asks, he says, give us young guys some advice on finding the right gal.
Well, that's a tough one. It's when they say opposites attract, I think there's something to that, but really there has to be some commonality in it. And, you know, not to be superficial, there's also has to be a certain level of attraction as well, but really the ability to understand that we're still individuals, because even though my wife and I have been together for a long, long time, we still really respect each other's individual, you know, passions and everything that goes into it as well. We're a unit, we're a couple, but you have to find someone who can respect and allow you to love what you love and not expect change. I'm not the greatest at relationship advice, but my advice would be find someone who respects the passion that you have for whatever you have, and make sure that's part of it as well.
And now we have some life-defining questions for Chris Coast. So we start with Nate, who says, Chris, we're going to learn a lot about you on this one right here. Dog or cat person?
That's not even a question mark. It's definitely dog. And the biggest reason why is I don't have a major allergy to cats, but I have a minor one with cats. I don't dislike cats, but I happen to really love dogs. I'm not going to say like I'm 100% dog. I'm not a guy who's going to have five or six dogs, but I love a good dog. As a baseball player, when I throw batting practice to my 12-year-old daughter with tennis balls, my 14-year-old cockapoo is the shagger. He will run around and grab all the balls and bring them back. So when you're a baseball player and you have a dog that will shag all the tennis balls, it doesn't get any better than that.
Aaron says, you coach professional baseball in North Dakota and coach college baseball in Minnesota. So which state is better?
Exactly. Both of them. I claim both states because I was born in Minnesota, mostly grew up in North Dakota. But when you're that close to the river, for me, I feel like the Fargo-Moorhead area is its own, like, D.C. It's its own municipality in a lot of ways, even though they're separated by states and you vote in one state, you pay taxes and stuff like that. When you grew up in the Fargo-Moorhead area and have a connection to Concordia College as well as Fargo South High School and the Red Hawks, it's I don't, when people ask me where I'm from, it's, I have to stop and actually think about it sometimes. Like if I'm traveling and someone asks me, where are you from? I have to, sometimes I say North Dakota, sometimes I say Minnesota, because I don't know what to say. If I said Fargo-Moorhead, they'd have no idea what I was talking about. So I pick and choose, and to ask which state is better, I don't know if there is such a thing, because Fargo and Moorhead are so unique with regards to their particular state. Fargo, you know, it's different than a lot of North Dakota, and Moorhead is different than a lot of Minnesota. So I feel like we have our own state. I'm not saying that we should secede from the nation, because, you know, we all love America, but at the same time, we kind of have our own little region up here that until you are a part of it and see it, and the proof I have is the players who come to Fargo, even opponents, if they have never been to the Fargo-Moorhead area and they're here for 3, 4, 5 days, or as a home player and they're here for an entire summer, they absolutely fall in love with it. It's the summer weather is amazing. I mean, if you were to look outside today, it might be 90 degrees one day, but today I think is a high of 75, and as beautiful a day as you're going to get. And so the fans love baseball, and it's I've lived all over the world, and I don't think I could permanently live anywhere else but the region and where I live.
And we end this week with Blake, who says, we now know that you're the volleyball champ in the Coast household as well. So is Chris Coast so competitive that he would spike a shot at his own daughters?
Not even close, because here's the situation. I know people think that I'm like the world's most competitive guy, and I'm not. I'm really good at picking and choosing my spots. I love what athletics brings, and even on the baseball field, yes, I'm competitive, but I, as much as I hate to lose, we all hate to lose, I learned early on that losing is part of the deal, and how you respond to it does define your character to a certain extent. Doesn't mean you got to enjoy losing. Nobody wants to. You want to win championships. I've been incredibly lucky my entire life to be around the world's most amazing baseball people. And the world's most amazing baseball people were unbelievably competitive, but they also knew how to accept losing. Shea Sutley was a great example. You're not going to find many people more competitive on a baseball field than him. He hated to lose, but he also let it make it made him better. So that's kind of always been my theory. I have no problem losing, and I'll finish with this. In 1998, when I was with the Red Hawks, we were one of the best teams independent baseball has ever had. We finished 70-22, and we were scoring 7-8 runs a game, and we faced Isla Borders. It was the first female pitcher to pitch in professional baseball, and she struck me out twice. And I hated striking out, but if there was one person in this world who was not bothered by striking out to a girl, it was me. And a month later, I got to see myself on 60 Minutes striking out to a girl. So yes, I'm competitive, but I can also handle the failure.
That's awesome. Chris, thanks for joining us this week.
You got it, Rob. See you next week.